Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy. This week on the show, I talk to Cillian Murphy and Rebecca Ferguson and Tim Roth, as well as Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight, all about the new Peaky Blinders movie, The Immortal Man, which is now in cinemas. I also talk to director John Patton Ford about his new dark comedy, How to Make a Killing, and putting Glenn Powell in the lead. And all the TV you'll want to stream or skip. You can email the show, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. And I do hope you're doing well and enjoying the St. Patrick festivities. I notice lots of people are doing Lent. People of a religious and indeed non-religious persuasion. And it's kind of in the middle of it now with St. Patrick's Day, where you're supposedly, I don't know who makes these rules, but allowed to give up Lent. What you're giving up for Lent, you're allowed to take a break for a day. But a couple of people asked me this week what I was giving up, and I'm not giving anything up. I gave up booze. I was off alcohol for January, dry January, did a whole month. And it just seems that when I do an inventory of what I want to give up, that's about as far as I'm prepared to go, 1 month at the start of the year. So I'm very much on things for Lent. I'm doing the opposite, it would seem. But anyway, and let's get to TV, which is what we're here to talk about. And this week I was watching a delightful show.
Dad, I love that you're here, but I don't need you to check up on me.
I'm not checking up on you. They asked me to come and read.
Oh, come on, Dad. You hate this place. I've asked you like a billion times. Just admit it.
I don't want to admit it because you will get mad.
Everybody knows.
Knows what?
About Archie. Everybody knows. This place is like a fishbowl. He knows.
He doesn't know.
Hey, excuse me. You know that my husband left me to f*** a grad student, right?
Oh.
Answer honestly, and I promise this moment is over for you.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
See?
Okay.
But you know, the worst part is everybody keeps asking me what happened. I don't know what happened. We were normal, and then the next thing I know, he's with her, and I'm packing up and moving into the dead hockey coach's house.
How did the hockey coach die?
I think he killed himself because his father was focusing on the wrong part of the story.
I'm sorry. I'm back.
Yes, that is a clip from the new Sky show. It's also on Now TV, called Rooster, starring the great Steve Carell, opposite Charlie Clive there, who plays his daughter, Katie. And in it, Steve Carell plays a well-known kind of pulp fiction writer who has a series of books, and the character's called Rooster. And he decides to come to his daughter's college because, as you heard there, she's having a rough time of it. Her husband has cheated with one of his students. Her husband happens to be one of the teachers, one of the professors in the college she's teaching in. She's teaching art history, and her life is kind of falling apart a bit. So Steve Carell, who's meant to be 58 in this, comes along, gives a talk, and he ends up kind of staying around at the college and giving some classes. And general hilarity and sweetness ensues. He's kind of a man out of time slightly, in that, you know, the college environment is very woke and he's not, even though he's not a, you know, boorish or anything like that, but he keeps putting his foot in it. There's a really interesting supporting cast. The college president is a hilarious guy who keeps taking cold dips and saunas. Steve Carell's character is a bit lost himself because he's still struggling with a divorce from Katie's mother, which was 5 years ago. So he kind of comes back to the college to help his daughter and maybe help himself. I really like this. It made me laugh a huge amount at times, like belly laugh. Steve Carell has entered that part of his career where he is like Robin Williams, in that he can do really funny stuff and he can do real sincerity. That idea of a man that you just kind of trust by virtue of his eyes. He's absolutely delightful in this. There are 10 episodes. It's dropping weekly. I've seen 6 and I absolutely loved it. I watched it with my wife and she really liked it as well. And it's getting mixed reviews. I mean, lots of people like, but there are plenty of people who don't and don't think there's enough to it. And look, for my worth, for what you pay me to do this? I'm telling you, I think it's terrific. And I think regular listeners to this show who converse with me about what they're watching will love Rooster. It's on Monday nights. It's dropping weekly. And I watched six and I was gutted. I didn't have any more for review because I can't wait. So now, unless I can work out, you know, some deal with Sky, which I don't think I can, I'm going to have to wait another 5 weeks to see the next new episode. And I'm bummed about that. So that's a good sign of how good this show is. So that is Rooster, Monday nights on Sky and on Now TV, dropping weekly. Steve Carell and indeed Charlie Clive are absolutely fantastic in it. Now, another big show from this week is this.
And how does the humiliation help?
Just because this will last forever. And they're always... So this is worse than going to jail, I reckon. Did you hear that? Is that a pedo? No, this is Louis Furex, mate, not a pedo.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Just so they know you're not getting stung right now.
By now, HS was keeping himself scarce, possibly troubled by the comments that had come in saying he'd be exposed in my documentary.
All right, you all right, girls? Have a good night.
The plan for a yacht party had gone out the window, so instead we joined Ed while he chatted up girls on the streets of Marbella.
You all right, darling? Having a good night? My dad is a 50-year-old virgin.
The aim for content like this is that short clips get shared and go viral.
Wait, what, you with my Instagram or you with my Instagram? What one? Both at the same time?
Everywhere Ed went, he was approached by young fans.
Ah yes, the unmistakable voice of Louis Theroux. You may have heard about this. This dropped on Netflix. This is Louis Theroux, Inside the Manosphere. Louis Theroux basically spends time, a lot of time, with three people in the Manosphere. Three unconstructed, unreconstructed, youngish men who are part of, I guess, a toxic masculinity cult. He follows three guys in particular, and there was, well, it is, it's three purveyors of this kind of stuff. You heard HS there, who's a young influencer. And what these guys have in common, there's one in America, two of them are in America, and this guy's in Spain, although he's English, is they are online and elsewhere preaching kind of unreconstructed masculinity where the man is in charge, women are there largely to make the home, and they have bizarre concepts like one-way monogamy. Well, bizarre to me, one-way monogamy, where the man is allowed to have as many partners as he wants, but the woman must only have one. And occasionally there is racism in there. They're pretty rotten people. All in all, I'm sure you're aware what the Manosphere is. This documentary is getting a lot of column inches and airtime. Some people aren't mad about it. Some people think it's great. I think it's a fascinating watch, albeit with some unpleasant company. But Louis Theroux, I thought he was on fire. I'm a massive Louis Theroux fan. I think I've seen everything he's ever done. I felt over the years, maybe at times he was repeating himself a bit. And you kind of always knew the way a documentary was going to go, as much as a fan as I remain. But I have to say in this, I just thought he was brilliant. Louis Theroux's great ability is to handle awkwardness, ask awkward questions, and stand looking seamlessly gormless as someone struggles to give him an answer. And I felt in this he'd taken it to a higher level, an art form. And also, they try and usurp him a bit in this. And in particular, that TikToker guy you heard there, HS, tries to kind of troll him live at one point in front of him online. And he just handles it all brilliantly. And, you know, if there is a winner in this, he's definitely the winner. And I don't know, with his age, he seems prepared, even more prepared now in a more considered way to ask very difficult questions and put himself in kind of harm's way. So I thought he was brilliant in this. This is a great watch. It's a really good watch. Louis Theroux, Inside the Manosphere on Netflix now. It's a one-parter. I think it's an hour and 40 minutes long. The people in it that he's dealing with are pretty rotten people. There's some criticism that he doesn't focus more on the women in these relationships that these guys in the Manosphere have. And I can see that, but I think maybe the point of this was to show just how toxic and downright unpleasant some of these characters are. So I thought it was a great watch. Louis Theroux inside the Manosphere. Louis Theroux back to his very best. Now let's talk about this.
You slept with my sister. Stowe Gypsy Fair, 1914. She had your baby, Duke.
I know all about the baby and the man he has become. I left you my kingdom.
No, you abandoned your kingdom and you abandoned your son. He wasn't ready for it.
If it's money he wants, I gave him enough. Hear me? If it's trouble he's in, I've trouble enough on my own.
I know all about your trouble, Mr. Shelby, and I don't think you're going to be able to write your way out of it. You live in a house haunted with ghosts.
Yes, I mentioned last week that Peaky Blinders is back. The new movie, or the movie, Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man. It is still in cinemas. It's not coming to Netflix until the 20th of March, so that's next week, but it is in cinemas. I told you last week it's really good. Peaky Blinders fans will be very, very happy. We're Birmingham 1940. Amidst the chaos of World War II, Thomas Shelby, Cillian Murphy, is holed up in a crumbling mansion, but he is driven back to face his most destructive reckoning yet. With the future of the family and the country at stake, Tommy must face his own demons, of which he has many, and choose to confront his legacy or burn it to the ground by order of the Peaky Blinders. Obviously, you might have heard Barry Keoghan is in this as well, playing his son Duke, who is now in charge of the Peaky Blinders and who may well burn it to the ground. In tandem with this, we also have a kind of Nazi story going on, and Tim Roth, the great Tim Roth, plays this character Beckett, who's basically trying, working for the Nazis, even though he's an Englishman, trying to flood the British economy with lots of money to derail the whole economy. One aspect of the war. Stephen Graham is in there later. Rebecca Ferguson, who was on the show late last year for The House of Dynamite, who stars in Dune and Silo and all sorts of great things, plays Kaolo. She's the sister of Zelda, the late mother of Duke. Kaolo is the queen of the Palmer witches and seemingly able, possibly, to communicate with spirits. And it's her gift, which you kind of heard alluded to there, that gets Tommy Shelby back out of retreat. So I got to talk to the great Cillian Murphy and indeed Rebecca Ferguson about their respective roles in the new Peaky Blinders movie and a bit more besides. Thomas Shelby has always been a man of kind of ghosts and haunted by the past. As soon as we met him in season one with World War One and all that.
Yeah.
Yet this one, I was really surprised by, and I mean it in a good way, how long he's holed up in the mansion, crumbling, just looking to the past and lost for like a good half an hour of the movie. And I wonder for you, was it a nice kind of twist? You're like the Citizen Kane guy, nearly just staring into shadows.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very nice structure, and it's a very familiar structure. It's the kind of one last job, you know what I mean? One last gig, and he's rattling around in that house, and he's kind of weighed down by everything, you know. Because I think once somebody like that stops, all the past comes crashing in, and so he's really struggling, and he's removed himself from the world. But myself and Steve always talked about it like, you know, you're just drawing it back, drawing the spring back until you release it. And then when he comes back, then it should be very satisfying. You know, it's like Unforgiven. That's a great reference.
Yeah, it is a great. I wish I'd made it now. But anyway, I quoted Citizen Kane. That made no sense. Rebecca, your character is interesting. And I was watching this with my wife and I turned to my wife and I said, is this lady actually like ghostly and magic, or is it a metaphor? And she kind of went, shh, it's both. she does that all the time. But anyway, let's not get into that. But is there magic in this? Is your character magic, or are we meant to just see it as metaphorically how she connects with Cillian or Tommy?
We talked a lot about it. And I think there are different ways to answer the question, because there's the reality of acting the character, which is obviously fully realism. And then there's the interpretation of the people around her. Mm. And then it's sort of for the audience. But I think what's wonderful is kind of what Cillian said, she kind of trespasses, not trespasses, but she kind of merges between the two worlds, which creates that sort of, not an unpredictability, but there's that sort of a veil over her where you can't really grab her. It feels like if you would hold her, she would just kind of vanish. Which I think speaks also to the whole show and what has been sort of the innermost important part as well in Tommy. It's like in comes this person and she just knows which strings to tap onto and then lean back and just see it all kind of unravel or activate. So there's no clear answer. Sorry, that was really unclear.
That's good. I think maybe, you know better about it than I do. So that's good. Killian, Barry Keoghan is inspired casting as your son and another Irishman who can do Brummy so well. And he looks like your son in this, not to age you, but just there's something about him that looks like, were you so happy when you saw him on set and you got, Jesus, it's me 25 years ago? Or what was your take when you saw him in full costume?
Well, it was a very easy and a very difficult piece of casting at the same time, if you know what I mean, because we didn't really have anyone else in mind except for Barry. And I've known Barry for a long time. We did Dunkirk together when he was a youngster.
A skitter.
But like, you needed someone who has that kind of unpredictability, that danger, that kind of charisma. So the casting was very important. Apparently, he tells me I texted him on Father's Day, which I didn't know it was Father's Day.
There's a story where Killian has texted them about offering a role or something, and he goes, "What, mate? No."
Apparently, I texted him on Father's Day, and I said, "Listen, do you fancy playing Duke?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm in." He'll tell the story way better than I.
But that's a good Father's Day text again.
Yeah, I think I'd forgotten it was Father's Day, or no one had alerted me, whatever.
Okay.
Well, I wish I was more calculated than I am, but
he's great.
He's amazing in it, and it's that sort of he's instantly interesting when you put a camera on him. That's ultimately what it is.
He sizzles for me.
He does. He sizzles. Just in closing, as I leave, Killian, when this goes out, we will be a day away from our countrywoman, sorry to Irish it up, Rebecca, possibly winning an Oscar for Hamnet. You gave her award on BAFTA night, and I watched it live, and you had a massive smile when you read it out. And I just wonder, do people in those award show go, don't act too happy, whoever's in the envelope? Because you seemed genuinely thrilled.
Oh, I mean, I am thrilled, and there's no two ways about it. You know, she's just an astonishing actor and astonishing in the film. And you know, I admire her, and I admire the way she's dealing with all of this so elegantly and so brilliantly. So like, fingers crossed. It's a strange thing. Like, how can you compete against other actors and other performances? It's bizarre, this whole run that she's in, but I'm so thrilled for her. And
he doesn't like the other ones, really.
They're all amazing.
But, you know, they didn't give out to you for smiling too widely then, no?
Oh, I'm not bothered about that, no.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she's amazing.
God.
We're out of time. The new film is for fans of Peaky Blinders. It's great. So continued success, guys, and I'll see you on the next one, hopefully.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Killian Murphy there, wishing Jesse Buckley the best, and indeed Rebecca Ferguson there, both of whom star in Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man. We have more Peaky Blinders after the break in the form of its creator, Stephen Knight, and also the great Tim Roth. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show, continuing some more Peaky Blinders stuff on foot of the new movie that's out, Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, coming to Netflix next week, but in cinemas now. You could do a lot worse than watching it this weekend if you're not busy drowning the shamrock and other such things. Tim Roth, the great Tim Roth, is in Peaky Blinders. As I mentioned earlier, he plays Beckett, kind of the guy tasked with hoping to derail the British establishment working for the Nazis during World War II in Birmingham and trying to flood the economy with lots of money. He's a pretty nasty guy, as Tim Roth can often be. Lots of people know him from his Quentin Tarantino movies, also The Hateful Eight. He's done all sorts of things. I don't think Tim Roth needs any introduction. So I had a word with him earlier in the week about Peaky Blinders.
Good.
I'm a great admirer of your work. So it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Tell me this, you know, The Sopranos, which isn't the show we're here to talk about, had lots of fans, famous actors who kind of wanted to be part of it. And I gather there was a touch of that about Peaky Blinders. Had you ever quietly hoped they might give you a call even before the film?
No, I couldn't stand the show. It was a nightmare. No, I honestly didn't cross my mind. My whole career is anarchy. Anyway, and in the best sense of the word, I think, but for me. But it didn't cross my mind. And what happened was I texted Killian after when he won the Oscar, because I knew it was going to be madness. I said, I hope you're all right. You know, because we worked together, you know, a million years before, and we'd seen each other over the years, and I had his number in my phone. So I said, I'll check and see if he's all right. So I checked to see if he was all right. And he said, yeah, I'm doing all right. He said, do you want to be in a film? I was like, what? Yes. And so, and he sent the script, and that was it.
Well, he told me earlier that he texted Barry Keoghan on Father's Day saying, do you want to be in Duke? So you guys with your phones, it's the way to go.
It was just like, and I think he did it with Rebecca too, where he asked Rebecca to be in it. Wow, you know, because I think he's producer on this thing. Yeah. So, and we just like, yep, gotcha.
Yeah.
And then I had to decide whether to watch the show or not, because I'd never seen it before.
Okay. You genuinely hadn't seen it before?
I had not seen it. I knew actors. I'd worked with actors who'd been through it, and I'd bumped into them when they were filming it.
Yeah.
You know, in Liverpool and whatnot. But I know I'd never seen it, and I decided not to watch it before filming.
Wow.
And because I thought it would be good to go to it completely fresh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just to go in there. And I think it was the right decision. So now I've got the whole thing. I'm going to watch it all. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. You know, they said that when they read the part of Beckett, they thought of you, some of the actors in the script. And, you know, you don't need me to tell you how you act, but you do a great line in, you can be very calm, and yet there's a steely terrifyingness about you as well. You can be relaxed and easy, but also petrifying. And you really ride that line with Beckett in this, I felt as well. He's under calm, high effing Hitler, as he says at one point, and then other times he's terrifying. Do you see that as a particular gift you have as an actor?
Well, I don't know. Possibly, but
maybe you don't think about yourself in those terms.
He wasn't written the way that we did him.
Okay.
He was actually written quite aristocratic and regimental, and so when I was up and running, went on board with it, I got on a Zoom with Tom and with Stephen, and I said, what about if, you know, because we have one of those sessions, I said, it'd be nice to talk character. I said, how about if I play him like a geography teacher? Like, you know, kind of from working class background, but very quite articulate and reasonable, but gentle and pretty persuasive.
Yes,
he's got a good point. He's just trying to save the world, and you know, make sure everyone's okay. He's the good guy.
Yeah,
and they were up for it, and so we started, you know, making space for him to just sit and watch and just engage and
be
very reasonable. It's a really nice guy, because he would not have been able to discuss or talk to these guys if he was upper class or if he was regimental or if he was that guy.
Yeah.
They would have kicked him aside and kept moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we did that, and that kind of, they were very much up for that.
Yeah. Well,
making him human.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. It really worked well. Tell me this, and I hope you don't mind me asking, but I often wonder, I wonder when I found out I was going to talk to you, has your life in restaurants become very strange because of Reservoir Dogs, because you were part of the famous tipping scene? Have you felt obliged to over tip as a result for that? Or do waiters give you a hard time in restaurants or assume you're going to over tip?
I always solidly tip.
Okay.
It never comes up.
Well, I'm glad I asked.
I could have never done that job. I would have been in fights with customers from day one. I would have been fired probably before the first day was over. So I've seen what they have to put up with.
Yeah.
And so, no, I'm always a solid tipper anyway.
Well, catering's loss is the acting world's gain. Continued success, Tim. Nice talking to you.
Cheers, mate.
The great Tim Roth there talking to me about being a good tipper on foot of his role in Reservoir Dogs all those years ago. But ostensibly, he was talking to me about Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man, which is now in cinemas and will be on Netflix next week. And you're listening to Screen Time. You're listening to some of the cast and crew of the new Peaky Blinders movie. And of course, Peaky Blinders was created by Stephen Knight, the man who gave us Peaky Blinders. Of course, he created he also gave us Dirty Pretty Things. He has written this. It was directed by Tom Harper, who gave us Heart of Stone, and the man who directed Jesse Buckley in Wild Rose. And I got to talk to both Tom and Stephen Knight about the success of Peaky Blinders, as well as the new movie.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm a big fan of the TV series, so I was so relieved when I saw the movie and thought, yes, you've done it. So congratulations to you both. Stephen, you probably know this better than I do, but, you know, George Lucas, when he sat down to write Star Wars, had no money or anything like that, and yet conceive of this 9 arcs of storytelling that would span years and all. In your wildest dreams, when you sat down to write Peaky Blinders, did you think it, or did you have a vision of all these series and then a kind of grand finale, possibly in World War II? Or were you just trying to get the first one or two off the ground?
I mean, I'm a great optimist, but even I was not so optimistic that I thought this would happen. I didn't think that it would have the international effect that it had. That gave it, and the success in America gave it a lot of energy. So from then on, we had the momentum to keep it going. But it, with each series and with each year, it got bigger and bigger, continues to get bigger and bigger, so that, you know, I hear...
You knew, though, didn't you? I remember talking about season one. You knew where you wanted Tommy to
get. Yeah, I wanted to end it. I always wanted to end it in the Second World War, because I wanted this to be the story of a family between World War One and World War Two. But I didn't think that we'd probably get there, and not in the way that we got there.
Yeah.
They didn't. You didn't think they'd give you that much track, I guess, figure it out. Yeah. Tom, one of the things I love about the visual aspect of the film is, in a weird kind of way, Birmingham and the surrounds look nearly more bruised and battered than they do in 1919, even though supposedly society's improved a bit. Maybe it's the war or whatever, but and the mansion where Tommy's holed up. Like, did you try hard to make it look so shattered?
I mean, I think, like, on a historical level, I think because of the Blitz and because of the nature of the Second World War, I think it had knocked Birmingham and the country, in fact, to smithereens. So there is that, but there's also the what's going on with Tommy at that time, where he is, you know, he is falling apart at the seams. He is crumbling. His soul is crumbling. So there is definitely, you know, we wanted to capture that feeling, particularly in the house where he lives, which is isolated and deserted and crumbling and once grand and now crumbling. So yeah, that's definitely part of it. But also, Peaky's always had this slightly heightened feel to it. Anyway, it's mythic. We're always reaching for that sort of slightly mythical storytelling feel.
Yeah. Stephen, sorry, I'm quoting another director at you, but I interviewed the director Todd Phillips for the Joker movies, the recent ones. And he said, you know, he said to the guys, you're not going to sell pajamas off this telling of this story. And to me, in a way, you know, Peaky Blinders would seem that way, that this is a dark thing about all sorts of things, you know, better than me. And yet it's had this life in theme nights and board games, and that must have surprised you.
Totally, yeah. It was not a prime candidate.
No.
Or you know, entering the fashion conversation to begin with. I remember and Tom will probably remember when the actors were first given their haircuts. They were sort of horrified, and they said, "Well, we're going to have to wear hats when we go out because of this haircut."
Yeah.
And then not that long afterwards, it was like footballers and everybody was having the same haircut. So it didn't seem as if it would be embraced by the mainstream in the way that it has been. But it just goes to show, which I think is really important, no one knows anything.
Yes, indeed. And then finally, a really pretentious question for both of you. I occasionally thought of the philosopher Nietzsche. I was thinking about the title, The Immortal Man. I was thinking about fascism, and I'm apologized for such pretentiousness. No. But was that in your mind in any way?
Totally, totally.
Okay.
And you know, the last two series as well, the whole idea that someone like Tommy, who you might think would embrace Ubermensch, Superman, because you know he's obviously self-evidently is superior in many ways in the way that he functions, that he didn't embrace that. He doesn't embrace that. He became a Labour MP. He fought against it. And this, I hope the surprise at the beginning of this is that he's stepped back and he's not taking part in this most crucial moment. And then he decides he must. But yeah, Nietzsche is always interesting.
He's a man of the people, isn't he, really? And I think that is almost his, you know, because he does some pretty bad things, let's be honest.
Yes.
Always, really, even though he does these bad things, they're usually for the right trying or reaching for the right reasons. And that is ultimately comes back to Small Heath and his family. He's actually, he's a defender of his family and of his community. And I think there is something political in that.
I mean, I always think of him as a good man doing bad things for a good reason.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That's why you are who you are. Listen, we're out of time. Congratulations, guys. Well done.
Okay, thank you.
Stephen Knight there, the creator of Peaky Blinders and the writer of the new movie Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man. And you also heard the director there, Tom Harper, talking to me about the new movie Peaky Blinders, The Immortal Man. Yes, great cast. Tim Roth, Cillian Murphy, Rebecca Ferguson, Barry Keoghan. A lot of acting talent in that movie. So as I say, I really enjoy the new Peaky Blinders movie. And if you're a Peaky Blinders fan, I think you will too. Now, after the break, there is a new movie out starring Glenn Powell, a great new movie called How to Make a Killing. It was written and directed by a very interesting man called John Patton Ford, and he joins me after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening in cinemas this weekend is this.
Since the day I was born, my mother told me we were different. Yes, she had been disowned by her family, but someday I would become the sole heir, the real estate, planes, an island or two.
Beckett, no way. Are you living in the city now?
Yeah, I do. I do. A little outside of it.
Whatever happened to the Redfellow family fortune?
I'll inherit it. Someday.
Well, call me when you've killed them all.
Yes, that was a clip from a new film that's out this weekend, the 13th of March, called How to Make a Killing. And an entertaining one it is, too. It stars the great, or the very popular, at least. He's pretty great, though. He's a great actor. Glenn Powell as Beckett Redfellow, who is the heir to the multi-billion dollar Redfellow fortune. However, both he and his mother have been ostracized by the father, the grand man of the Redfellow fortune, played by Ed Harris, the unusually named Whitelaw Redfellow. And we catch up with Glenn Powell's character, Beckett, years later when he's working as a tailor in his 30s, and he meets his kind of childhood sweetheart, Julia, played brilliantly by Margaret Qualley. And she kind of hints that if he could get his hands on that Redfellow cash, they might get together. So kind of figures out a way to kill all the other Redfellow family members so he can get the fortune and indeed the woman he wants. This is a funny, entertaining movie with, I guess, shades of like American Psycho, but it's funnier than that. And Glenn Powell is very charming. The way he goes about killing various people is kind of humorous at times. It is a not a farce, but it's a comedy, but serious at times as well. It's loosely based or a reimagining of an Ealing comedy from the 40s called Kind Hearts and Coronets. It was written and directed by a man called John Patton Ford, who gave us a very interesting movie called Emily the Criminal in 2002. And John Patton Ford is an interesting guy. This is his second feature as writer and director. The movie was on what's called the blacklist for a while, which is this famous list of scripts that haven't been made, but people want it, but they just haven't for various reasons. So I caught up with John Patton Ford to talk a bit about How to Make a Killing and about being on this blacklist.
Yeah, that's right. The initial draft was on this list called the blacklist, which sounds like a bad thing, but yeah, it's actually a good thing. So Hollywood makes this list at the end of every year of scripts that have not been produced yet, have not been made into movies, but which everyone is reading and everyone seems excited about. And it's kind of a limited list. I think usually has about 60 titles on there. And it's a good list to be on, and we were lucky to be on it.
But it can take a long time to get out of developmental hell from there, I gather, to actually getting the thing made.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes stuff kind of gets made quickly and other times it doesn't. And this one just had so many different lives. It went through so many different iterations through the years and then finally kind of ended up here. It's a weird full circle kind of moment.
Now, I haven't seen the original Kind Hearts and Coronets, but I this isn't, I mean, it's loosely based on it. They're not quite the same.
I would say it takes the concept of that movie and kind of the structure of that movie, but it's different in the sense that, well, I mean, number one, it's contemporary and takes place in the U.S. Kind Hearts and Coronets takes place in London in 1906. So it's different in that sense. But then it's also different, like it's a different genre. Kind Hearts and Coronets is kind of a farce and a screwball comedy, you know, a black comedy, and it's... you know, it's its own genre. Whereas this is different. This is certainly a dark comedy, but it's also more of a thriller. It's a bit more grounded. Kind Hearts and Coronets famously has one actor, Alec Guinness, playing every single victim to wonderful effect. Whereas this movie doesn't do that. All the victims are, you know, played by different actors. And when we kill them, they don't come back 10 minutes later dressed up as somebody else. We actually kill them.
Yeah, now Glenn Powell, he's, you know, the actor du jour. He just has a great kind of Cary Grant, Tom Cruise, if that's not mixing the actors too much, vibe to him. He's great. He really is. Did you always have him in mind for this, or was it a happy accident?
I didn't always have him in mind, only because, you know, the script kind of predates most like broad public knowledge of,
yeah,
of Glenn. He wasn't really quite as visible when it was first being developed, but certainly when he popped up and became part of the conversation, I was pretty enthusiastic about it. Glenn is not just a terrific actor, but a terrific person, incredibly focused and hardworking and kind of leads by example. And I just thought it'd be great. He's also, I just had fun thinking about him in this role because he's not a dark or nefarious person by any means. He's an incredibly bright, well-meaning, hardworking guy. And I just thought, that's funny. Someone being bright and hardworking and genuine, who has this huge ethical blind spot that they just never quite reckon with. That's there's a counterpoint to that that I think is compelling.
Yeah, I was actually going to be my next question. Like, he's obviously not well in some ways, because going around killing people is not a good thing to do. Most psychologists agree on that. And yet we root for him a lot because of maybe mistreatment. Is there a wider metaphor at play here about, I don't know, maybe there's no such thing as wholly bad people? Or how do you see him in that way in terms of how the audience feel about him?
I think he's a guy who he has really big dreams and he really, really wants something. And he's going to work really hard to get that thing. And this is, for me, I think it's why the audience is on his side and is rooting for him and is cheering him on. It just happens to be his method of getting that thing is like insane, you know? But I think as long as it's in service of a dream that we ourselves understand, perhaps a dream that we ourselves even kind of share with him. The dream of being really successful and, you know, having all this money and resources and stuff. I think people are invested and will watch him, you know, throughout any number of murder. It doesn't mean that we sign off on murder.
No.
But like, I think also the movie's capitalizing upon our communal resentment towards, you know, the offensively wealthy. I think in the US especially, we just have an emerging class of people who control way more than any one person should. And I think a lot of audience members actually want to see them die. The movie's not enough. They actually want them to kill them in real life.
Our communal disdain. I like that. Now, I mentioned metaphor there a minute ago. You know, I gather you really wanted to be a movie maker and you know, you wanted it so bad. It became idée fixe. And I read in the production notes that that overwhelming desire kind of found its way into this script. Is that right?
You know, I think maybe this was not a conscious thing.
No, sure.
You know, But now looking back, I do see some parallels. I think I've made two movies now about people getting after something that they want and breaking the rules and kind of doing everything they can to get that thing that they want. And, you know, perhaps it should come as no surprise. I've spent most of my early adult life trying to do something really competitive and really difficult and you know, against all odds. And I think that has seeped into my subconscious. That's become who I am. It's become my identity in a way that is now informing the work for better or for worse.
Tell me, you know, you're the writer director on this and you were on your previous film, Emily the Criminal. Is that the way you want to do it? Like you just want to make sure you write them as well as direct them?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're also living in a time where no one really just becomes a director. It's kind of a rare thing now to break through as just a director. You sort of have to produce the material yourself. You have to come up with the thing yourself and then arrive as the full package. It's sort of how it works. But per your point, yeah, it's not just the being on set and shooting something that is appealing to me. It's I like telling the entire story, or conceptualizing the story, incepting it, you know, developing it. The shooting of it, the directing of it is just one little piece of that much, much larger story, you know?
Yeah. A lot of people are making parallels between this and American Psycho. I don't know if you see that as reductive or what you make of that. I mean, the killings are different and all that, but what's your take on that?
I mean, you know, you should be so lucky to be compared to American Psycho. It's a great film. It's a classic. And if people want to draw those parallels, they're certainly free to, you know. I mean, Glenn does work in finance and wear a suit in our movie, so we're kind of asking for it.
Yes, you are.
I'd say anyone who goes into it hoping that it's like American Psycho 2 are probably going to be let down because it's a very different kind of movie once you get into it. American Psycho is about a guy who's sadistic and is beyond all reason drawn to murdering people for no reason beyond the fact that he enjoys doing it. Whereas this movie, our central character does not like enjoy killing. He's not drawn to kill people because he gets some kind of sadistic pleasure from it. It's just that's what he feels he has to do in order to get this larger thing that he really wants. So it, you know, kind of a different story.
Yeah, and look, the killing, as I say, is more nuanced, and there's a sleuth aspect to it. Not that you need me to tell you about your film or explain it to you. So listen, I got to ask, I'm interested in what you're going to do next.
Well, I don't know yet. I'm trying to figure that out right now. But I'm not sure. I definitely like doing something different every time, you know, and playing in a slightly different sandbox every time. Well, I'll probably never be someone to make the same kind of thing over and over again.
Sure.
Perhaps if I were smarter, I would. Perhaps if I were smarter, I would just build a brand and stick to it. I'm not quite sure. I'm working on a couple things, you know. I'm working on like a period piece right now. It's kind of like my first movie. It's like this stressful thriller, kind of like Emily the Criminal. But it's imagine Emily the Criminal, but it's like 1862. That's what I'm working on currently with some people.
I could get down with that. Well, listen, from one John to another, I really enjoyed How to Make a Killing and continued success. And thanks for talking to me.
Thank you, John. Be well, John.
Yes, John Patton Ford there talking to me about his new film, How to Make a Killing, starring Glenn Powell, which is now in cinemas. And it's an entertaining movie, I have to say. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Misha Barton about taking Double Indemnity to the stage. So all of that to come next week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday on the Go Loud app at 5 p.m. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. on News Talk. And of course, it's repeated this week on St. Patrick's Day at 6 o'clock as well. So I will leave you now and wish you a happy remainder to this whole St. Patrick's thing, and hope you have a nice time. Leave you with a little music from the movies and for the day and weekend that's in it. This is one of the greatest Irish songs ever written. It was originally recorded for the film Sid and Nancy, and then it was later re-recorded by Shane McGowan and Sinead O'Connor for the film Stolen Heart. So I leave you with the glorious Haunted and wish you a happy remainder to your day.
Do you sunny day somewhere in London in the middle of nowhere? Didn't have nothing to do that day.
This summer, the world's best tennis players are coming back to Cincinnati. The Cincinnati Open returns August 8th through the 23rd. Bigger than ever, with new fan spaces, incredible food, drinks, and entertainment all in one place. Voted Tournament of the Year by the players themselves. Community Weekend starts August 8th. Finals weekend, August 22nd and 23rd. Get your tickets now at CincinnatiOpen.com.